VIP.
Welcome to The B-Side, a podcast that engages thinkers, mostly sociologists, at the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and much more. We're your hosts,
Corey Fields
and Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University. So as we do each week, the episode is introduced by one of our favorite, or maybe not so favorite, B-side recordings. This week, Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby, which was the B-side track.
Yeah, which I didn't even realize there was a B-side, one. And two, did I miss the memo about having white people open up the show?
Hey, no, you did not miss the memo. It's just that there are so few B-sides out there for me. Hey, if maybe we should do a crowdsourcing type thing where we get people writing in, tweeting in with some B-sides, but you know, we gotta work with what we got. So
fair enough.
This week it is Vanilla Ice. Which was Ed, so right. Ice Ice Baby. That was a B-side track to Play That Funky Music, which we'll play during our outro.
Well, the call has been issued, listeners.
Oh my goodness. So joining us today are our guests, Julius McGee from Portland State University and Cesare Warren from Michigan State University. Julius Alexander McGee is an assistant professor of sociology at Portland State University. His work focuses on the relationship between societies and the environment, and he is the author most recently of Can Reducing Income Inequality Decouple Economic Growth from CO2 Emissions, forthcoming in Socius. And Cesare A. Warren is assistant professor in the Department of Teacher Education at Michigan State University. And Cesare has about a decade of experience as an urban educator. His research examines factors that support the high academic success of young Black men and boys attending urban schools. And he was the 2018 recipient of the Early Career Award from the Teaching and Teacher Education Division of the American Educational Research Association. His 2017 book, Urban Preparation, Young Black Men Moving from Chicago's South Side to Success in Higher Education, is the inaugural text published on Harvard Education Press's new Race and Education series. So, Julius and Cesare, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
that's great. So, as we do on each of our episodes, of which this is now the fifth, right? We start out by talking about your work. So, I figured, Julius, alphabetically, we'd start with you and talking about your work.
So the paper you mentioned, which is forthcoming in Socius, sort of explores the relationship that rising income inequality has to our societal contributions to climate change. And so the logic of that approach is to sort of look at alternative avenues to addressing climate change. So oftentimes, you know, a society will do something like implement renewable energy resources as a pathway to decoupling economic growth from emissions. And that becomes sort of the focus of a lot of international policy around climate change. So since 2015, I believe, there's been what we call a decoupling between economic growth and carbon dioxide emissions, which is sort of the holy grail for a lot of scholars who are working in this area, which notes that now we can sustain economic activity without contributing any more to CO2 emissions. And I think that that's a limited perspective of the story. And that's kind of where this particular paper, but other research that I've been doing has been looking at, which is, yes, economic activity is continued without contributing to climate change. But the question then becomes, what type of economic activity and how does that affect people? And so in this particular piece, my co-author and I kind of determined that one contributing factor here is that as we see rising income inequality, the effect of economic growth on carbon dioxide emissions actually increases, which we sort of suspect is due to the changing landscape of economic development. So things like financialization, right? Increasing percentages of economic development coming from financial institutions, which contributes heavily to income inequality. And so we've kind of taken that into different steps as well. So in some other research that's forthcoming, I've looked at you know, on a national level, how this is linked to racial inequality in the United States. And so similarly, asking the question of how does, you know, rising inequality between in communities of color, how does that affect carbon dioxide emissions that come specifically from travel, noting that rising inequality has sort of placed an extraneous travel burden on a lot of people of color. And as a result, we've seen increases in carbon dioxide emissions in counties where that's occurring. So the broader issue that I'm trying to tackle is just sort of, you know, providing caution to this recent period of decoupling, because I do think it's sort of, it can be dubious. And it's, you know, one small event in a general trajectory of how economic development has sort of historically operated to promote inequality, but also to, you know, increase carbon dioxide emissions.
That's great. So I actually want to, I want to talk a little bit more about the specific findings that you have in this, paper, right? So one of the things that you find is that, you know, and you're looking at the specific time period, 1985 to 2011. Why that time period?
I mean, as is the case with a lot of quantitative analyses, you're at the mercy of available data. So that's the most widely available data. And the other sort of end of that is we look at 35 developed nations specifically because also the mercy of data. I wanted to make sure we were accurately assessing the situation. And particularly with the variables in some of those models we look at in that paper, which is the percentage of total income that that belongs to the bottom 20% of income earners and also the top 20% of income earners. That data is pretty new. And it's not as comprehensive as we would like it to be. So it really is only, you know, robust for a handful of nations, in this case, 35. So we wanted to make sure we were consistent with our analysis, but we also thought it was, you know, important to sort of explore how does this effect change when we move income shares around, meaning that when we sort of increase the general wealth of the bottom 20% of income earners, does that, you know, change the nature of the relationship between economic development and carbon dioxide emissions? And we find that it does. And it does by sort of what we note is decouples that relationship, meaning that growth continues, but there's less carbon dioxide per unit of GDP that increases. So that contributes to decoupling. And, you know, that should be a pathway to addressing climate change forward as far as how societies adapt the general ways that they develop their economies.
So what do you think the explanation of that is, right? So if you concentrate on the top 20%, right? Mm-hmm. And you look at the increases there as opposed to the bottom 20%, right? Why is it that you find this increase in the association between economic growth and CO2 when you're increasing the share for the top versus the bottom?
I think there's lots of avenues for that. The sort of more direct answer is the majority of even financialization, majority of economic development is premised off of the use of fossil fuels, such that most of wealth that's generated in an economy, particularly wealth that goes to the top 20%, is heavily tied to the extraction of resources, mostly the emission of carbon dioxide. And when you start to distribute wealth more equally in a society, oftentimes that entails also the creation of more of a democratic engagement with energy sources and energy uses. And so one of the arguments has sort of been established by other scholars in my field, so you know, Liam Downey and David Pillow, is that one of the consequences of rising income inequality is the creation of non-democratic institutions. And as a result, those non-democratic institutions tend to control the allocation of fossil fuel resources. So just sort of an anecdotal example to that, the way in which we would say implement any type of energy source that would reduce carbon dioxide emissions like solar panels or wind energy, when that's done in societies that have a huge distribution of wealth that leans toward the top 20% of income earners, that's usually done in the benefit of those groups. So meaning, you know, it's sort of implemented in society for profit shares. And then when we see, you know, more equal societies, so in this case, you know, people where there's more wealth that's being generated from the bottom 20% of earners, they have more control over how those energy sources are implemented. So that could mean having better access to renewable energy sources. So maybe there's subsidy programs to increase, you know, access to solar and wind energy in low-income societies. And so that sort of democratizes how we allocate energy sources in society. And a lot of the follow-up research I'm doing is really attempting to establish just that, which is we have this general trend. Now let's get at the particulars. And so some more recent research I'm doing is finding just that, that one of the limiting factors to increased renewable energy consumption at the national level is income inequality. It tends to reduce the effect that renewable energy has at reducing carbon dioxide emissions. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, the profit incentive attached to it, which is if your drive is to simply make money from renewable energy, it makes sense to, you know, market it to those who can afford it. But if your drive is truly to reduce emissions, then you might more equally distribute who has access to those resources. And those decisions tend to sort of fall along economic lines.
Yeah, this is actually really cool stuff, Julius. I was wondering if, I mean, so one thing that struck me is that when we talk about like issues of the environment and environmental related stuff, it seems like it's relatively recently that we've been talking about the environment in relation to issues of stratification. So is this something that like environmental activists have like recently sort of started getting into, or is this like the scholarship has pushed this? I guess as someone who studies this stuff, what's been your sort of a general take around issues of the environment and issues of like stratification and inequality overall?
So the way I kind of, I always look at it from the just developments of the field. So in, you know, environmental sociology, you know, wasn't a field that was really started by sociologists. It was kind of something that happened outside of sociology and then kind of entered into it, asking for a new paradigm. And I think that has a lot to do with the lack of an open dialogue between a lot of environmental sociologists and and general sociologists who look at stratification. And so the kind of, I guess the field that I come out of, there's not much discussion over how maybe the environment is particularly tied to or tied to inequality in such a way that we would anticipate that outcome, at least quantitatively speaking. Theoretically, that's been the case. And there's a lot of environmental justice research, but that similarly puts the centerpiece on humans and sort of humans' exposures. That's how inequality affects it. And so when I came into graduate school, a lot of this research is kind of sparked from debates that I would have with a lot of my colleagues, predominantly white, about, you know, why we should care about inequality and why the environment isn't, we don't really all relate to the environment in the same way, in the sense that the degradation of the planet is going to be inherently tied to how we stratify our society. And so there's a lot of commentary around, we're all going to be affected by climate change, so we're all in this together. And I think that that's a problematic assumption. And so some of this work is just kind of, you know, proving to people like, no, it matters. Like it matters, you know, where you live. It matters how you relate to wealth. Mm-hmm. And those things truly do matter. And we should really, you know, consider that. So, yeah.
I think that's great. Okay. So Cesare, let's talk about your work now.
Well, first of all, I appreciate being invited to be a part of this conversation, and so thank you for including me. So I'm broadly interested in the factors that support high academic outcomes for young Black men and boys. And I've done that work by studying both empathy, the utility of empathy for how teachers communicate and respond across racial and cultural difference, and really thinking as an applied field, similar to social work or counseling, how it is that folks can tap into the human capacity of empathy and leverage it as a tool to improve relationship building and interactions with young people that produce outcomes that are representative or indicative of culturally responsive teaching. What we talk about is culturally responsive teaching in education. The other way that I do that, which is the line of work that the book is sort of produced from, is looking at how young Black men and boys sort of talk about the experiences, people, moments, incidents that they believe or perceive have really impacted their education trajectories. So the book is based on a study of 17 young Black men who are from the South Side of Chicago, who happen to be my former students at a school that's gotten a lot of national attention called Urban Prep, for getting 100% of its graduates accepted to college. Part of the impetus for the study in the book was to really explore what the 100% actually means, and not from the perspective of those who most benefit from being able to say that we got 100% of the students to college, but from young men who actually went to the school, went 4 years through the school, to kind of talk about how attending this particular urban high school that has been celebrated for its role in improving urban education and rewriting the narrative on Black boys, what they perceive that this school has done for assisting them in their college persistence and retention. So the book is what I would call a critical race counter story. It sort of acknowledges the anti-black racism and anti-blackness sort of as a condition of Black folks in this country from the time we got here, and the school sort of be born out of the need to rewrite the narrative of the stories about Black men in the mainstream, and what that then actually means in terms of the logics for how the school was organized and what it did for putting these young men on track for college and careers. So the book really is trying to understand both what young Black men say are important experiences or factors for their success, but also what weight they put on why those experiences are important. So these young men who are in the book and in this study are invited into the meaning-making process in a way that I think is important, because when we talk about urban education reform and what we need to do to improve urban schools for youth of color, particularly Black and brown youth, we too rarely include the voices of the young people, but also make those voices central to our meaning making.
I think that's great. You know, as someone who is also who also does research in sociology of education, and just someone who grew up in urban settings and urban schools, I totally appreciate your work, and it really prompts me to think more about, you know, sort of urban educational reform and how in so many cities across this country, we seem to equate urban education reform with the proliferation of charter schools that are in many ways pretty much cookie cutters. And, you know, my favorite whipping boy or girl, I should say, in these debates is Success Academy, Eva Moskowitz's charter school empire, and the ways in which I actually think that these schools, even as they claim to be about Black excellence, are actually about, you know, taking as a given sort of Black pathology and Black deficiency, and trying to figure out ways to deliver education in ways that I actually don't believe are about Black excellence. It's actually about, you know, Black zombies.
Right. I mean, I think that so white supremacy, I think, explains how social institutions are structured to continue to privilege those who are white, heterosexual, cisgender, you know, wealthy, able-bodied, monolingual men, right? But it doesn't go far enough to explain the logics by which explain Black people's experiences in these social institutions. I think anti-Blackness does that in a bit more precise way. And so when you say Success Academy and other no-excuse charter schools, I started my career in a KIPP school, and it was an awful experience for lots of reasons, but to be a Black man teaching all Black kids with all white staff members and a white principal who was hell-bent on controlling and manipulating these kids to all think, talk, act, and be the same. I didn't have a language for being able to describe why it was so problematic, but it doesn't do the work. It actually undermines the work that folks say that they are about, which is inspiring creativity and flexible thinking and critical thinking and engaging the world in a critical way. It actually teaches Black kids how to conform and be in a society that already doesn't view them as fully human. And so the question that I raise is, what is the role of schools and schooling when we think about the education of Black kids in particular to rehumanize the institution such that Black kids start to self-determine who and what and how they want to participate in this society once they come to recognize this society as sort of established on the backs of their ancestors? That's an important question, and we can't move away from that question as we think about contemporary schooling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I refer to it as the sunken place, but
didn't the sunken place give us a language to talk about Black folk? Like, it, I felt like the sunken place gave us a theoretical frame that really, like, we all got why Ben Carson is who he is. What's a sunken place? You like, we get you now, Ben. We get you.
Okay. So let's turn those sociological gazes onto something less academic, but no less sociological. So Corey, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, it seems kind of hard to escape having to have a conversation around Black folks in public spaces. We can channel this specifically through Starbucks. And so I'd be very curious to hear people's general takes on the incident itself. I mean, I guess, you know, for the any listeners who have been on Mars the past few days, right? There are these two Black dudes in Philly who were arrested in a Starbucks as they were waiting for someone to come for a business meeting. We've probably all seen the footage on YouTube. And so, right, so there, you know, obviously and reasonably some outrage and pushback on that. So I want to talk about that event itself, but I also want to talk about the Starbucks response to it, which has been to say they're going to close down the corporate-owned stores. I think it's on May 29th for some in-house training, because it sounds like the villain in all this, if I'm to believe Starbucks, is unconscious bias, y'all. Unconscious bias. Look out for those wanted posters, because people are coming for you, it seems like. So, I'm very curious to hear general takes on that, takes on the response. But then I guess also, as this general issue, because in the immediate wake of the Starbucks case, I just read about some Black ladies in Pennsylvania getting the police called on them at a golf course. So I guess, yeah, in general, this conversation around, like, you know, what the fuck is up with Black people can't go nowhere without the cops getting called, especially if you're trying to do white stuff like drink coffee and play golf, I guess. But yeah, so I don't know. What do you all think, smart sociologists?
I'm always baffled at the elusiveness of white supremacy. I mean, it seems as though we always point the finger in the wrong place. And that's not to, you know, let Starbucks off the hook here. But, you know, if you go back and you look at that video, you know, this is an, you know, an internalized bias of racism that is being acted out by, you know, this clerk, right, who is responding negatively to these Black men are just sitting, you know, and waiting. And then the sort of societal response is to, you know, point the finger all at Starbucks and say it's this problematic. But then we see the reverse being the case when we can, we talk about, you know, police brutality. It's, you know, we're talking about the individuals, not the institutions. And so it's just, it's fascinating to me. I don't know if you guys caught this. There was a, you know, another video that came out several days afterward of an individual who was asking to use the restroom and was denied access because he hadn't purchased anything. And then he, you know, waited at the restroom for a white guy to come out, asked him if he had purchased anything. And the guy said no. And so they went back
right, yes,
and was like, what's up with that? And that didn't have the similar backlash. So I'm sociologically speaking, I'm always fascinated about, you know, why people seem to care about specific instances. I mean, did it have to do with the fact that the cops are involved and that really fits a narrative that kind of, you know, tugs at the strings of white guilt, where it's like, see, I wouldn't be that person though, because I would never call the cops, or I wouldn't be that terrible cop. And those are my questions, I suppose, that come up. Those are general thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it does, like the cop involvement does raise the stakes a little bit, partly because we know once the cops get involved, then all kind of shit can like pop off, right? So like, you know, the use of state violence, police shootings kind of stuff. So I guess maybe that's why this caught sort of fire the way it did. I mean, obviously, because one of the things in the fallout has been, you know, the innumerable voices being like, this happens all the time. I guess since we're like riffing on other things related to this, if at some point somebody can duck in and talk a little bit about, I don't know, this sort of manufactured performance of white innocence around all this, because that's also this whole like, I had no idea this is what happens. This is what's going on. I mean, obviously Black people are like, yeah, I'm not surprised that this happens. But what seems increasingly hard to believe for me is that non-Black people haven't been hearing these stories for endless time. So like this whole like, well, oh my God, what? This is so crazy. I'm outraged too. it's starting to feel a little more disingenuous, like with each Black person that the cops get called on.
And, you know, and for me, and I've said this before, right? So if it's May 29th, that's a Tuesday, people are going to be looking for their lattes and their shots of espresso. And they're going to be like, damn those Black people. Right? Because of Black people, no, I'm not getting my coffee.
They're going to be mad at unconscious bias, girl. This is all the playing.
Black people ruin everything.
They're going to be mad at unconscious bias.
Right? Right? And so the narrative is going to shift and it's going to change, right? It's going to be, why is this such a big deal, right? Why is it such a big deal that Starbucks has to close their stores for an entire day and thus inconvenience me for something that has nothing to do with me?
And there's no one day of training that's going to undo 20, 30, 40 years of your life on earth having inherited and inhaled all of these messages around Blackness as something to be scared of and disdain. Like, there's no one day going to do nothing for that. Not for real.
And how long does anybody even work at a Starbucks? How often they going to do this training? You know, it's like, hey, like, this isn't a long-term career that folks have. This is a job people have. Some people probably don't have, you know, less than a year or whatever. So, yeah, no, not going to help and going to constantly need to be redone. And how much of, I will tread lightly here because I don't deeply know the literature on unconscious bias, but it didn't seem that unconscious to me. Like, it seems like this is maybe just straight up conscious bias. I see Black people and this is not
suspicious.
Cool. And right.
I mean, they're just sitting there doing nothing, but, you know, they look suspicious. It reminds me of, you know, when there's been so many Black men gunned down for no reason. I think this was Terrence, the guy who was coming from school on his way home. His car stopped in the middle of the road, I think Oklahoma or something. Mm-hmm. And from the helicopter, they looked down and it was like, oh, he's this big bad dude. You know, like this, it's both irrational and unconscionable, but also at the same time, if you sort of think about the logics of anti-Blackness in structuring social relations from, you know, colonial time to now, it makes sense that white people would view it, and not just white people though, because there's a global preference for whiteness and a global disdain for Blackness. So that's also not like just local to America. But if we don't ever, if anything should come out of the unconscious bias thing, we need to be just talking about over your lifetime, do you recognize that you have internalize all of these messages and logics around Blackness is really bad and whiteness is really good and innocent. And now how do you start to do the work of reconciling that? I don't know if, are they going to put people on a professional development plan over time? You know, like what are they going to do as a sustained sort of effort to, you know,
well,
improve
I'm-
the consciousness of their folks?
I mean, my whole thing is, you know, and I think what we're all getting at here is that, you know, that Starbucks employee is just part of this broader society, right?
Right.
And
right.
And my whole thing is, even if Starbucks figures out a way to make sure that all of their employees serve you your coffee, right, without calling the police, you know, just because I can enjoy coffee without being harassed doesn't mean that once I leave Starbucks that it's not going to start all over again. How Starbucks going to solve all that with just one day of training?
Don't go to Waffle House because they coming for you too. I just saw that.
Lord. Well, I mean, since you mentioned that, Corey, there's no way we can't segue into that right now. Right. And you know how I'm going to segue into that? I'm going to segue into that by saying, I'm being really truthful here, is I heard Nashville, I heard Waffle House, and I was like, Lord, please don't let him be Black.
And this is the thing, Waffle House, you know, you have in a week when the B-side mentions Waffle House and we got two stories to talk about because I wasn't even thinking about the shooting just yet. So that one actually, right. Yeah, like I definitely felt like with that one, I wasn't sure what it was going on. I actually kind of thought this was just a story about Waffle House and like my initial response is I assumed it was white on white crime, that, you know, scourge of America right now. Mm-hmm. But this actually was some white on black crime.
I did too.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. So the word is this guy, had a track record of mental health issues, multiple arrests. I guess they took his guns away and gave them to his dad, and then his dad returned the guns to him. And
see, that's when I knew he wasn't black. Because number one, they gave his father the guns. I was like, they wouldn't be giving no black dude no guns. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, a confirmation that he wasn't black was certainly given when you found out he shot up the place naked, ran out, and was peacefully arrested somewhere later. So, yeah, that's...
And then given a bond.
Right, and put on bond after killing four people. Yeah, no, that's... Yeah, that, I mean... I'll be curious to see how this story plays out. I mean, it seems like in terms of in relation to the, you know, gun law or stricter control over gun laws movement and that's bubbling up right now in the U.S. It'll be interesting to see how this case fits into this narrative of gun control, right?
Like, it seems like a textbook case for them to sort of, you know, just deem this as another mental health issue.
Right.
And, you know, to really emphasize on mental health and gun violence, which I think is the worst possible outcome of this. I mean, this to me is a really good chance to open up a conversation about the intersection of race and mental health, particularly when we're talking about white supremacy. Because when we're looking at this guy and we're acknowledging that he, you know, is suffering some from some mental health problems, but then we look at, you know, what did he do with that? How did he respond? How was he subsequently treated? How was he treated at all levels with law enforcement due to his mental health? That's the intersection of race. That's the conversation needs to go. I mean, the reality is we like to paint this image of, you know, around gun violence, particularly when it pertains to white people, as it's just a mental health problem. But that doesn't, the numbers don't add up.
Yeah. Right?
That's just not the case. And so this really is an intersection of whiteness and mental health. And that's where the conversation really needs to go, in my eyes.
You don't have to have a PhD and be a researcher to like notice trends in the ways that white terrorists are get talked about and how they get handled by police and how black folks get handled by police. And at this point, with the ubiquity of social media, of these images playing out over social media and in the public eye, there's no way that we can continue to sort of medicalize deviance, to borrow from colleagues in criminal justice, to sort of talk about him as just this mentally ill person who is doing these things. And when folks try to construct Black Lives Matter as a terrorist group, when do we heard a black person going up and shooting up a whole white church or shooting up a whole place where white people are? Like, it doesn't make sense to continue to have the conversations in the same way.
Well, it comes back to this idea. I think that, you know, when we were talking about in relation to the Starbucks stuff, right? I think part of this is driven, I mean, most of this is driven by the extent to which, you know, fundamentally Americanness gets defined in a way that excludes blackness, right? Like blackness exists outside of true Americanness. And the way that we structured our conversation around terrorism, right, is this attack on America, which is coded as not black. And so when things attack black people, you can't really think, it's hard to talk about them as terrorism because it's not like an attack on America. It's just like, oh, that, a crime.
That makes a lot
because
of sense.
Like blackness and Americanness don't fit together. As you all can tell, I was teaching Du Bois in my undergrad theory class this week, but always topical. But I think you're right, Cesare. That, like, right, why aren't we talking about, you know, this Waffle House thing? It goes back to the South Carolina church shooting, right? Like the hesitance about calling these attacks that white people do on non-white people terrorism, right?
And we have a schematic reference for what a terrorist actually is that is predominant in our sort of mainstream American psychology, right? Like a terrorist looks a particular way. So it's really difficult for us to, I think, as mainstream media, folks who are controlling how how the mansion gets access to these stories and how the stories are framed, they're not going to call it a terrorist because it just doesn't fit a schematic reference for what a terrorist is.
Right. And yeah, what a terrorist is and who a terrorist attacks.
Yeah, one of the things that I find interesting about this and the way in which the stories are being spun in the media, and I'm curious as to how this is going to contribute to the gun control conversation, is, you know, this time the person who stopped the bad guy with a gun was a good guy without a gun.
He was black.
I get it. I get that he was black.
Julius was like, no, keep this truth out.
And an alpha.
Right? And so, yeah, but it is interesting to me that, yeah, like he was able to disarm this guy without a gun. And so, yeah, I mean, so are we still going to keep using that tired line that says more guns are actually going to help keep us safer?
Well, yeah, you know they are. Who is we? Right. I was like, who is we?
All right. Okay. All right. All right. You got me there.
They're going to keep saying that, you know? But it will be, I think it will be interesting to see how, you know, how the story gets dealt with given certainly the race of the players, right? And how these dynamics play out. So it's sort of Black and Latino victims and a Black hero, if you will, of the story. And, you know, the sort of the killer is this white dude. I guess there's some potentially white supremacist backstory. I don't want to put out false, unverified information on the podcast. So, yeah, mixes up a lot of like media narratives, right? Or sort of cultural narratives into one story. And it's not quite clear to me how it's going to play. It certainly has. I mean, will it trigger a Parkland kind of response, or is that something to build on? Like, will it build on that, or will it just sort of fade away?
I think a lot of that rides on how. I mean, I think it's, we're already kind of seeing the outcome with the the person who, you know, doesn't deem himself a hero, the young man who stopped the shooter, opposed to the way everyone wants to pin him out. I mean, I've watched several discussions with him now, and he really is wanting to move himself out of the spotlight because he's, you know, talking about just wanting to survive and survival. And I think that's fascinating because when it comes to discussions about, you know, gun control and about people owning guns, particularly when it comes to the Black community, there's a lot of, you know, it's about self-preservation and the ability to protect oneself in a society that historically continues to terrorize them. And so to have this individual whose response to a shooter is self-preservation, right? He doesn't see himself as a hero. He was just like, well, either I'm going to die just, you know, like sitting here, or I'm going to at least die trying to, you know, save myself. And that was his approach. That was his mentality, right? And that's why he doesn't want to be a hero. He didn't do it thinking he's going to save any other people. So he's moving himself from that narrative. And hopefully that, you know, hopefully it does some good. I actually have a lot of admiration for him to sort of not, you know, not eat the cake or whatever you want to say, right? He's moving away from it, right?
And that's just Waffle House story number one. Like, Waffle House in Alabama, they attacking Black ladies for complaining about having to pay for plastic silverware, or I guess plastic utensils.
Oh my goodness.
Get it together, Waffle House.
Oh my
Get
God.
It together.
Corey, tell me we have some lighter fare to go out on this week.
Well, So when we're not talking about Waffle House, I also want to pick your brains on this Kanye West moment. So we all are. Well, Leslie's not on Twitter, so you don't even know about any of this.
I am oblivious, but if Kanye's involved, I'm sure it's crazy.
He's back on Twitter. He's back at it. He's been tweeting. I don't know. I guess, is it fair to frame them as efforts at sort of profound wisdom, sort of these one sentence tweets that kind of are providing a window into what Kanye is thinking about? And piecing them together suggests a flirtation or a dalliance with some right wing politics. So he's been.
Well, I'm just. Oh, I'm go just, ahead. Yeah, Candace Owens, right? That was the person he was. Yeah.
Right. So Kanye apparently likes the way Candace Owens thinks. Candace Owens is a Black conservative who has frequently called for Black people to sort of open up their minds and stop focusing on the past, stop looking to the past racism, and instead push forward to the future. This is, you know, sort of standard Black conservative rhetoric, right? Sort of the real problem Black people face is focusing on racism. So Kanye's co-signed this now. And people are not having it, to put it mildly. So for those of us on Twitter, and Leslie, now that you've got caught up, what do we make of Kanye West and this flirtation with conservative politics and the alt-right, some might even argue?
Well, maybe this is his way of getting over that Taylor Swift moment, right? Maybe he's been in therapy.
That is some theory.
I know, right? I was like, I kind of had to stagger a little bit. I'm like, wait, oh my God. I'm like that blinking GIF guy. Like, wait, Leslie has dropped some crazy knowledge. Maybe there's a Taylor West connect, or Taylor West. Taylor Swift connect.
Yeah, well, get over it. You know, there was his anger. And, you know, and if I were Kanye, you know, he was trying to stand up for, you know, for someone that he thought actually deserved the award, right? Namely Beyonce, right? And, you know, and I'm sure in his mind, and in the mind of quite a few people, there was possibly some bias going on in terms of who ultimately got the Grammy Award. And this might be just a way of Kanye trying to let go of his anger, trying to let go of the idea that racism and racial discrimination is, you know, sort of the facet of everyday life for so many of us. And, you know, and maybe this is how he's coping, right? I mean, maybe meditation would have been better.
I'm going to be very careful with my words here. I think there's truth to this in how it has benefited Kanye, right? I mean, sure, if a Black person lets go of racism as a pathway towards success, they're going to be welcomed into a white world that wants to sort of, you know, be complacent with the historical legacy of racism, not confront it, and then sort of move on and not acknowledge how it exists today. And yeah, that can lead to an individual's success. The question is, you know, is that really going to change like anything for the masses of the Black underclass that are experiencing poverty? And so, like, yeah, sure, Kanye can make that claim. Once he stops, you know, calling the President of the United States a racist, or saying he doesn't care about Black people on TV, or telling, you know, an audience that he thinks a Black woman should have won an award over a white woman, and sort of hinting towards the racism in his commentary there. Like, if once he stops doing that, maybe he gets taken more seriously by, you know, a broader audience of white individuals, and that might be the case with other folks as well. But it doesn't change the facts, right, about structural racism and things like that. So.
Yeah. Oh, see, now all that talk just makes me miss the old Kanye. It's like, right.
Well, we should miss the old Kanye, because I think he has a hell of a lot of trauma that he has not been able to fully recover from. And then he's married to who he's married to, and the family that he's married into. And then how do you go from George Bush hates Black people to I love Donald Trump? I mean, that's right. Part of this, you know.
Although, like, I will say this, I mean, not to be all like pop culture, but to be fair to Kim Kardashian, she has been a vocal anti-Trump person. So Kanye didn't get it from her.
She has been all about the people for a long time, I suppose.
Whoa, but, look, don't make a mockery of me. Not on my podcast to make me out to be a
I'm not trying to. The only way to explain it is like trauma and like the sunken place. Like, what? I don't know. It just doesn't make sense. And then there is is this a way for him to just like come back and reemerge as relevant to people, like get his self out. You know, they do these publicity stunts, I think, celebrities. And it'd be stuff that's completely made up. And they exactly. do it so that they can.
Right. And it's obviously no coincidence that he has new music coming out in June, right? Exactly. Like, I'm sure this is a way to sort of prime the pump. But one thing that's interesting about it, and, you know, made me think of something just in general, like, there's something about the current political stakes now that I think make this, in some ways, a risky gambit for Kanye, right? So in my own research, right, there's like a long period of time where like plenty of people were Black and Republican, even when most Black people weren't Republican, and nobody really cared, right? It was like your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving who was a Republican. It was just like, oh, shut up and eat the potato pie. Like, it was no big deal, but it was still not common. But then the political circumstances happened, and like Reagan comes into office, and there's this sense of like, you know, Black people are under attack, and the lead of that attack is the Republican Party. And so now it's meaningful to be Black and Republican, right? I think similarly, Kanye West, we could easily dismiss this if it didn't feel like the political stakes were so high right now with the Trump administration, right? And like, we would write this off as like Kanye being, it's like another silly thing Kanye West has done. Except for now, it's like, no, it's kind of important, and this isn't anything to play around with, Kanye West. Because I think the reaction has been relatively negative and relatively swift coming, right? But I think also consistent with other, like the more a more broad thing among Black conservatives, Kanye is trying to play this all off as like, people just don't get it. People don't understand me, or everybody is like too locked into the old ways of thinking. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's...
Well, I think there's also the, you know, Trump is like super... He represents everything that America is. And if you really buy into the American dream as a, like a real thing, like meritocracy, work really hard, build, pull yourself up in the bootstraps, then it sort of makes some sense that you would support and be like, yes,
okay.
To Trump.
Okay. Hold on a second there, Cesare. Okay, so what bootstraps, where did he get those bootstraps? That's what I want to know.
Chappelle?
Number one.
Kanye?
No, I'm talking about Trump, right?
No, it doesn't, and reality doesn't matter here. We're not talking about whether or not you actually have bootstraps. I'm saying he represents like, so for example, my dad is a Jamaican immigrant, and he texted me when it was like, I'm voting for Trump and you should too. So of course, I'm aghast. I'm aghast. But in his mind, he's like, Trump is worked his way up. He's done. And I'm like, you're not looking at no data. You ain't looking at no evidence. But that is the narrative that Trump spun to the country. Like, we gonna make America great again. And it's like this American ideal. And if you really like subscribe to that ideal, whether or not you actually pay attention to the evidence of the reality is a whole separate thing, because, you know, we don't be always liking to read books. So that's a problem. But this is like what people are doing. So,
well, you know what?
Kanye included.
Yeah, and, you know, and just the last thing I want to say about this topic is, I wonder what they talked about in that meeting at Trump Tower.
The part, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I made a joke like way back when I said, you know, I thought maybe they were talking about their meds. But, you know, I wonder if there was something else in that conversation that has led to this new outing of Kanye as a Trump supporter.
I don't know. It seems like probably most likely it's just symbiotic ego building. It's, they're useful fools for one another right now. So, yeah. Oh, Kanye. Oh, well. We'll see what happens when the album drops in June.
All right.
Maybe he'll become a hero of the alt-right. It'll be on Alex Jones. It'll be big up in the video.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. on that note of wisdom, you've been listening to The B-Side, a sociology podcast on the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and materiality. Thanks to our guests, Julius McGee from Portland State University and Cesare Warren from Michigan State University, for what I thought was a great conversation. We'd also like to thank our young producers at Queens College, Anika Chowdhury and Joshua Rivera. And we want to introduce our two new young producers, Vashti Williams from Georgetown University and, drumroll, Dana Hinkson from Hale Friedman World Academy High School in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. The B-side is part of the growing sociocast podcasting empire, as I like to say. So check out our sister programs at sociocast.org. And Corey, since I don't know anything about tweets, would you like to talk about our Twitter handle?
Yeah, you can find us on Twitter at @B-side_podcast. So check us out. You can get updates for when the shows come out, keep the conversation going, and yeah. And we can, let's start a grassroots campaign to get Leslie on. So tweet at @B-side_podcast, and I will print them all out and give them to Leslie.
You're so funny. I'm not that grandmotherly. So we're your hosts, Corey Fields and Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University. To take us out, here's the A side to Ice Ice Baby. Play that funky music. Just go to
please. Yep. Tweet at us with B-side so we don't have to have more Vanilla Ice.
Just goes to show, sometimes the B-side is way better than the A-side. So catch you all on the flip side.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.